The following Bible study is presented by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Thank you for joining us for tonight's Bible study, where we're going to be continuing in the book of John, this time in chapter 19. If you'd open your Bibles to Matthew 27, though, I'd like to begin by reading something there. Last time in John 18, we had studied the dramatic abduction of Christ and the false accusations against him as he was brought before Annas and then Caiaphas and finally to Pontius Pilate. This latter Roman ruler was not convinced of Christ's wrongdoing, and he was reluctant to sentence him. In Matthew 27, beginning in verse 17, "Therefore, when they were gathered together, that is, all the Jews and the others, Pilate said unto them, Whom will you that I release unto you, Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ? For he knew that for envy they had delivered him." And so, at this time of year, the tradition was that the Roman rulers would release one of the prisoners that were Jewish, and he gave them a choice at this time. "Do you want me to release Christ, who claims to be your king, or a known murderer and a thief, Barabbas?" In verse 19, "When he was set down on the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him, saying," that is the wife of Pontius Pilate, "saying, Have you nothing to do with that just man," referring to Christ, "for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him." And so she had a dream or a vision in which she was troubled because of his presence in this place and sensing a wrong about what was taking place at this time. This didn't sit right with her, and she therefore sent a warning to her husband about this because she was so concerned. "But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. And the governor answered and said unto them, Which of the two will you that I release unto you? And they said, Barabbas. Now Pilate said unto them, What shall I do with Jesus, which is called Christ? And they all said unto him, Let him be crucified. And the governor said, Why? What evil has he done? But they cried out the more, saying, Let him be crucified. Now not only did Pilate find no fault with Christ, but he was moved, we can see, by the statement made to him by his wife. And he therefore tried to release Jesus, even by offering a villainous man to take his place. Now surely, he must have thought, surely the bloodthirsty Jews would choose Yahshua over a thief and a murderer, a known enemy to the public safety. Sadly, they did not. They chose instead to release a villain and to have Jesus killed. If you go over to John 19, the judgment of the people who were inspired by the prince of the power of the air was to crucify Christ. Hoping to curb their harsh and unjust decision, Pilate took Christ and he had him beaten. In verse 1 of chapter 19, "Then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him." Now the scourging or the flogging that Christ suffered was not a beating that was done with a stick or a cane. This was much, much more severe. This type of scourging was conducted by a Roman soldier who was known as a lictor, and he would have had been trained specifically for torturous types of punishment. And so, because of this, he would have special tools and instruments at his disposal, and he would be able to bring the victim to near death and then stop and have them revived either by dumping water on the victim or allowing them to rest for brief periods between the flogs. Now, this would have begun by having Yahshua stripped to only an undergarment, and then he would be fastened to a pillar so that he could not move his arms or legs. Now, the tool used to inflict the blows was called a flagrum. It had a sturdy handle that was often ornately carved, and it was anywhere from maybe 6 to 8 inches long, And it also had 3 to 12 cords attached to it that were made of leather or chain. And these usually had bits of metal, bone, or even glass interwoven into the cords. Often, these metal and bone pieces were also hand-carved or fashioned specifically to fit the cords in an almost decorative-type manner. This was considered in some ways a sick type of art to some people. And so this beating would have been excruciatingly painful, with bits of skin and flesh being torn and ripped off as the lictor dealt blow after blow to Jesus. After what would have been a horrific experience for both Jesus and the onlookers from the carnage that they would have witnessed, the soldiers then proceeded to humiliate Yahshua as yet another portion of this unjust punishment unfolded. In verses 2 and 3, "And the soldiers plaited or twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe, and they said, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' And they smote him with their hands." With stark sarcasm, these Roman soldiers proceeded to make a mockery of Christ's claim to be a future king. They decked him with a purple robe, purple being a color of royalty, and they put a crown of sorts on his head. However, this crown was not one of beauty, showing elegance and dignity. It was made instead of thorny vines. Now, the exact type of plant this crown was fashioned from is not known. However, the soldiers would have grabbed what they had on hand, and because of this, it's thought that this crown was made from a plant called the Xanthium spinosum, which grew in bushes in this area, and it had long, bendable branches with thin, spike-like thorns that were 1 to 3 inches in length. Now, I have a picture of one of these, if you would like to pass it around. You can see that the thorns are not like those commonly seen on rose bushes. These ones are long and spiny, and obviously much more painful were they to come into contact with somebody's skin, as which they did with Yahshua. Now, there is some interesting symbolism found in what these soldiers hastily did to the Son of God, and I have two thoughts about this despicable crown of thorns. Let's turn over to Genesis 3. Put a ribbon in John 19 if you have one, and turn over to Genesis in chapter 3. First, I'd like us to consider what sin has done to this world. It has caused great pain and suffering, yes. But originally, that is after the sin of Eve and Adam, what occurred? Well, they hid themselves, didn't they? They hid themselves from God. They were ashamed because they now had a different perspective of life and the world in which they lived. In addition, the earth also changed, didn't it? Yes, it did. Because of their sin, the animals now began to rip and tear at each other. Survival of the fittest became the motto. And there was even a change in the plant life. In verses 17 and 18 of Genesis 3, God spoke unto Adam, and he said, "Because you have listened unto the voice of your wife, and have eaten of the tree which I commanded you, saying, 'You shall not eat of it,' cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to you, and you shall eat the herb of the field." And so we see here that the world would no longer be tame. It became a hard and dangerous place with perilous plants and violent animals. What these soldiers placed on Christ's head was more than just a sick joke. Could it be that it was actually a mockery inspired by Satan himself? Because these thorns, they are a direct result of mankind's sin. Thorns and thistles shall the earth bring forth because of his sin. And therefore, they can be a representation of what? Of sin, can't they? And so to place them on the head of Christ would be a way of saying, you are the king of sin. A title that is held by who? The devil, isn't it? I have another thought about this crown of thorns. I'd like you to consider that sin brings pain. And this crown would have been symbolic of the pain that Christ was suffering and the agony that was still yet to come. And therefore, this crown of thorns, it could have also represented the crowning achievement Jesus made, because he was taking upon himself the penalty of sin, a punishment that each of us would have otherwise been obligated to pay. Let's go back to Matthew 27. Along with the crown and the purple robe, the soldiers placed a reed in Christ's hand as a type of scepter. In Matthew 27, this time in verse 29, "And when they had plaited or twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and a reed in his right hand, they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' And they spit on him, and they took the reed, and they smote him on the head." As if the beating, the loss of flesh and blood, the false accusations and such were not enough, these men had to take it a step further. And in this you can see the sick, perverse satisfaction many men enjoy in their lust for violence and power, and in this case by dominating and humiliating a seemingly helpless and an entirely innocent man. Disgusting is not a strong enough word for this type of act. Vile, perhaps, is a bit more fitting. Back to John 19. Still, Pilate did not want to be responsible for the death of this man. He did not want Christ's death to be on his hands. In verses 4 and 5, "Pilate therefore went forth again and said unto them, 'Behold, I bring him forth to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him.' And then came Jesus forth, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe." And if you can imagine Jesus standing there, blood soaking through some of the garment, the purple robe, possibly blood dripping on the ground, his face appearing as if he was in agony from the pain he had suffered, and the crown of thorns on his head. "And then Pilate said unto them, 'Behold, the man!'" Now Pilate here was trying to show the crowd how much Yahshua had now suffered. I mean, blood would have been all over his body, flesh ripped and torn, the mockery of the crown of thorns and a purple robe. I mean, there Christ stood, a victim of treachery, evidence of the violence that men are capable of. Now surely, Pilate must have thought, surely those who lusted for his blood to be shed would have believed that this is enough, and they'll have pity on Jesus. But no. The crowd, like the Roman soldiers, were keenly tuned in to the prince of the power of the air, who broadcasted hatred and envy. And when they saw Christ standing there, instead of having mercy, their rage swelled. Verse 6, "When the chief priests, therefore, and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, 'Crucify him! Crucify him!'" Now, if you can imagine this zeal to do evil against Christ that was surging through the crowd. Now, if you've ever seen footage of a KKK rally, this is what it must have been like. The air was probably electric with hostility as these people harmonized with the devil's hostile wavelength and cried out with anger against a man who came as their savior. to show them mercy and love and instruct them in the ways of righteousness. Now again, Pilate was moved, but not with the crowd. A ruler such as Pilate would have sentenced many people to death in the past, and yet, in this case, he was anxious. His wife's dream, Christ's statements of coming to this world to become a king, this caused great uneasiness in Pilate, as well it should have. Now, because of this, he told the Jews to carry out this death wish themselves. Continuing in verse 6, Pilate said unto them, "Take you him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." And the Jews answered him, "We have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself to be the Son of God." When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he was even more afraid. The reluctance felt by Pilate was a direct result of fear. While these vehement Jews had no qualms about killing an innocent man who had performed great works in this area, both in word and with miraculous healings of the people. Christ was a man who knew the scriptures like no one they had ever come into contact with. And yet the Jews were unmoved, at least the vast majority of them. But here we see Pilate, an unbeliever. He was the one who felt mercy and was hesitant, hoping to save Christ's life. Because of this, in verse 9, he went again into the judgment hall, and he said unto Jesus, "Whence art thou?" That is, he's saying, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Now, Christ's lack of a response here was not because he did not have an answer. Obviously, according to the principles given to Moses and handed down to the Jews, if a person claimed to be God, they were blaspheming and they were worthy of death. But Christ here was literally God, so no such offense could rightly be held against him. However, in their minds, he was blaspheming. So when Pilate asked him where he came from, if Christ would have said, "From heaven," the accusation of the Jews would have proven to be true, at least from a carnal standpoint. Therefore, giving no answer was the best answer to give. It would have left a reason for Pilate to believe that, well, he very well may be the Son of God, but he couldn't know for sure. Pilate then asked another question, and Christ's response points to this truth. In verse 10 and 11, "Then said Pilate unto him, Speak you not unto me? Don't you know that I have the power to crucify you, and have also power to release you?" And Jesus answered, "Thou could have no power at all against me, except it were given to you from above. And therefore he that delivered me unto you has the greater sin." Now in this response, Jesus made two things clear. Both of these would help Pilate's uneasiness, a bit, anyway. Not that it made Pilate comfortable, but that he would no longer be afraid to allow a judgment to be carried out against Christ. First, he said, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given to you from above." And this is basically saying, you think you have control over my life, but you're like a pawn. And God is simply allowing you to make a few moves on this chess table of life. Now, second, Jesus said, "Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin." And so this told Pilate that because he was truly not in control of the situation, Pilate would not be held fully responsible for the outcome of events. However, those who brought Christ to him, these would have the greater sin because they hated Jesus and they wished to kill him. Pilate, however, found no fault, and he did not desire his death. But because of Pilate's longing to show Christ mercy, In verse 12, "And from thenceforth Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, 'If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whosoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar.'" Now the thought of being accused of working against Caesar sealed the fate of Yahshua. Pilate was now being forced to act. In verse 13, "When Pilate therefore heard the saying, he brought forth Jesus and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in the Hebrew, Gabbatha." And so this was a place where Pilate was getting ready to make his final judgment. It was an area that had many smooth stones in a mosaic pattern on the floor, with at least one seat for a judge to sit in. The Gabbatha was either designed or adopted for use as a tribunal. Pilate had been going back and forth trying to get the Jews to be content with a beating and the humiliating of Christ and then releasing him, but their hatred for Jesus ran deep. His accusers would not quit until he was dead. In verse 14, "And it was the preparation of the Passover, and about the sixth hour. And he said unto the Jews, 'Behold, your king.'" And so this verse indicates that the time was about noon. The daytime portion back then reckoned from 6 a.m., and the sixth hour would mean 6 hours after 6 a.m., being 12 noon. Now this is one of the several verses revealing that Christ kept the Passover on the correct day, being the 14th. And the next day, the 15th, would be the first high day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, if you'd allow me to expound on this for just a moment. The term Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread are titles used interchangeably in the Scriptures. They both refer to the same set of holy days, beginning with the Passover proper, and then 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread that would follow. Now consider, if you will, this interesting comparison. The first and last set of holy days of the year are like bookends, aren't they? They are different in their meaning, but the same in their number of days of observance. The first holy days of the year are 1 plus 7, a total of 8 days, that is the Passover proper, separate, but be included in the 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so the last holy days of the year are the Feast of Tabernacles. They also consist of 7 days plus 1, a total of 8. Now the last great day is separate, but it's still included in the Feast of Tabernacles, isn't it? And so the two feasts are identical in this numerical fashion. Here, in verse 14 of John 19, we see John calling this the preparation of the Passover. So how could it be the Passover proper if Christ told his disciples the night before to go and prepare the Passover, and then he kept it? It cannot. And this is because the actual Passover ceremony, it's not treated like a Sabbath, is it? No, it's not. We see that the evening prior would have been the time where Christ's Last Supper took place, and therefore the Passover proper. As Christ told his disciples in Luke 22 and verse 15, "With desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." And that he did, didn't he? Also in Mark 14, if you just pop over there for a moment, Mark 14, in verse 12, "And the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover, his disciples said unto him, 'Where wilt thou go, that we may prepare and eat the Passover?'" And so this was simply the first day of the entire feast, right? The first day that the feast had begun. It started with the Passover ceremony, killing of the lamb, and the family eating the lamb roast by fire. And the next day would be the preparation day for the first holy day that would be treated like a Sabbath. Now the word prepare here in Mark 14:12 is the Greek hetomaizo, and it means to prepare, provide, to make ready. And so the next morning would have been the daytime portion of this day, a time to prepare for the first high day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And this would have been a high day that is likened to a Sabbath in the way that it is kept. Now the word used by John in verse 14 of chapter 19, it's not the same word used by Mark when referring up to preparing to eat the Passover meal. The word used by John is preparation, and it's paraskuia, and it means a readiness, a preparation. And this is a term that is used specifically when referring to the day prior to the Sabbath or prior to a high holy day, also known as a preparation day. And so this word is used 7 times in the New Testament. In every instance, it is used in connection with preparing for the Sabbath or a high holy day. Mark 15, in verse 42, if you'd look there, is another place where this word is used. When it reads, "And now when the even was come, because it was the preparation, that is the day before the Sabbath." And here's that word, paraskuia. Luke 23:54, you don't have to turn there, but it's another place where it reads, "And that day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew on." If you turn back to John, in chapter 19, and in verse 31, "The Jews therefore, because it was the preparation that the body should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath day was a high day." And so here it is. This indicates that Jesus kept the Passover ceremony on the correct day, and that he was crucified on the preparation day before the first high holy day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, a day that was approaching that would have been a day of rest and a holy convocation treated like a Sabbath. And so I apologize for this digression from the main topic, but these are important considerations when determining the correct observance of the Passover, because there are some people that claim the Passover should be kept on the 15th and not the proper 14th. So let's go back to verse 14 for the meat of our study this evening. "And it was the preparation of the Passover, and about the 6th hour, and he said unto the Jews, Behold, your king." And the people did not like this statement at all. They did not want Christ to be their king. At least the vast majority of them did not. In verse 15, "But they cried out, Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him! And Pilate said unto them, Shall I crucify your king? And the chief priests answered and said, We have no king but Caesar." Can you imagine these priests of Judah in Israel saying such a thing? "We have no king but Caesar." I mean, they despised Caesar, and they only submitted to his rule because it was either submission or death. However, now, because it suits their cause, they claimed allegiance to Caesar, as if to say, you know, "Hey, Pilate, you and I, we're on the same team. We're just like you Romans." In addition to this deceptive use of citizenship, it was God who was to be their king. And in denying Christ, they also denied God as their sovereign ruler. As Christ previously said, in chapter 16 and verse 3, "They have not known the Father, nor me." Now, because the Jews now promoted Caesar as the only king over them, Pilate, obviously being a servant of Caesar, was forced to rule on the side of the Jews, understanding that, you know, a possible siding with Jesus, who was claiming to be a king of these people instead of Caesar, could have been construed as treason. John 19, and verse 16. Then delivered he him, therefore, unto them to be crucified. And they took Jesus, and they led him away. And you can imagine the crowd filled with angst in anticipation of crucifying Christ. They likely cheered and bellowed with wicked excitement because of this ruling. Verse 17, and he, bearing his cross, went forth into a place called the place of a skull, which is called in the Hebrew Golgotha, where they crucified him, and two other with him, one on each side, and Jesus in the midst. The word cross used by John here in verse 17 is the Greek word staros, and it means a stake or a post that is set upright, specifically a pole or a cross. Now, considering the pagan symbolism in the cross, pointing to the god Tammuz as well as others, and also considering the many references to staros in the scriptures, it's the opinion of the Eternal Church of God that Christ was crucified on a wooden post or a stake and not a cross, as most believe. And of course, there's more about this in great detail and a lot of information regarding the background of the cross in the booklet published by the church titled The Truth About the Cross. In any case, Jesus carried or dragged this large post all the way to a hill known as Golgotha. Now, this name means the place of the skull, and it was called this because it was a natural rock formation which looked like an enormous human skull. Today, this mound still exists, and I have some pictures here if you'd like to pass them around. It's a rocky area that, of course, has been subject to thousands of years of erosion, but you can still see the infamous skull as associated with this place. And there's also a couple of pictures here which show some buildings and a bus so that you can get a perspective of how large this mount is. It was the late archaeologist Ron Wyatt who had done some excavation of this place in the late 1970s, and while excavating, he discovered holes that were carved out of the stone where they would place the posts of those being crucified into the rock so that the posts were able to stand upright with no supporting ropes or beams. So Christ was brought to this infamous place where many crucifixions had been performed there. And here he was nailed to a large wooden beam, and the timber was then raised up and placed into this hole bored into the rock, and as it hit the bottom of the opening, it would have shook, and Christ's body would have shuddered with pain as the weight of his flesh and bones pulled on the nails in his wrists and in his feet. Verse 19. And Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross. And the writing said this: Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And so Pilate seems to have wanted to show the irony of the hypocritical Jewish leaders and those who followed them. They claimed Caesar as their king, but Pilate knew better. He understood that they did not like Caesar, and they did not favor the Roman occupation. And so here hung a man that was innocent of any wrongdoing, a man who claimed to be acting on the behalf of the Jews, and he was, in the truest sense. Strangely enough, those people he is destined to rule over, desired for him to suffer and die. Why? Pilate saw right through the false accusations and understood that their lust for blood came from envy. I mean, Christ was magnetic. People were drawn to him and to his message. And the Jewish leaders, they could not stand the thought of him drawing the focus of the people away from them and to himself. And therefore, Pilate stated it like it was. The truth of the matter is that he is your king, and you killed him. In addition, this would have been good propaganda for Rome, wouldn't it? I mean, a statement to the Jews saying, you know, if you desire a king outside of Rome, here is what you're going to get. He's going to die. In both cases, this was a slap in the face to the Jews. In verse 20, this title then read many of the Jews, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near to the city, and it was written in Hebrew and in Greek. And so Pilate wanted all to be able to read this bold statement so that there would be no misunderstanding. And then said the chief priests of the Jews to Pilate, "Write not the King of the Jews, but that he said, I am the King of the Jews." And Pilate answered, "What I have written, I have written." And so the Jewish leaders did not like this at all. They wanted the sign taken down, but it wasn't going to happen. And Pilate's part to play in the death of the Savior was done. He washed his hands clean of it, and he declared this truth. Christ was, and he is, the King of the Jews, but not of them alone, also of the Greeks, the Gentiles, and of all Israel. There could be no misinterpretation of Pilate's inscribed words. Here is Yahshua of Nazareth, a king who died for you. And so that concludes tonight's Bible study, the first half of chapter 19. Next time, we will cover the painful second half of this chapter and discuss the many prophecies that unfolded, as well as Jesus' last words as he hung on the stake.